The Guardian.
Hello and welcome to the Guardian Football Weekly Extra. And it doesn't matter who's at the wheel when Jay Rodriguez hits one like that. Burnley win at Old Trafford for the first time since 1962, giving us another great chance to ask what's wrong at Manchester United. Also today, are Arsenal better when David Luiz watches the game on a little TV in the dressing room? Are Southampton going to get into Europe? And is it a coincidence that Florian Lejeune can now express himself just days after talking about disposing of dead bodies? Elsewhere, Leicester find West Ham the perfect opponents to remember how to be good again. Bournemouth finally win a game, and Kevin De Bruyne to Sergio Aguero gives City all 3 points at Bramall Lane. Nicky's here, so we'll do a deep dive into Serie A. It all goes peak tong late on for Ibiza as Barcelona overcome a cup scare, and there's fun from France, Turkey and Northern Ireland. All that plus your questions, and that's today's Guardian Football Weekly Extra. On the panel today, Mark Langdon.
Hello, Max.
From the Evening Standard. No, you're not, are you?
No.
You have just been signed. It's in January.
The
window's open.
The way that sort of people are talking about betting at the moment, it may not be at the Racing Post for too much longer, but no, it's Racing Post until transfer window's still open.
Excellent news. Hi, Nicky Bandini.
Morning.
Fresh from the live show in Brighton.
Fresh is the word.
Yeah. Thanks to everyone who came to Brighton. Did you have a nice time in Brighton, Barry?
I did, yes. It was really good fun. And I had a nice train journey home with Ellis James afterwards.
Your best friend.
Yeah.
Did you wait behind so you and Ellis could just go home together?
No, we were both going to the same station.
Sounds like a coincidence to me.
Well, we both live in South London.
That was a coincidence, wasn't it?
I moved there specifically to be near him.
To be further away from me. Anyway, let's start, shall we? Old Trafford, Manchester United 0, Burnley 2. We will get to Manchester United, but we should give Burnley some credit, shouldn't we? First win at Old Trafford since 1962. To be fair, the last time Manchester United beat Burnley at home was the 11th of February 2015. Two goals from Chris Smalling and a Van Persie penalty. But Burnley, Nicky, was superb last night, weren't they?
Yeah, but it's a weird thing, isn't it? Because I think actually Burnley had been 2-0 up on both their last two visits to Old Trafford. So it was almost like, sort of, can we finally get it across the line this time? Which they did. I mean, they were comfortably the better side. I thought Chris Wood's goal a little bit came off the shin. There was a little bit of rolling down the shin action on that one, but still sort of taken decisively. And the second goal was obviously fantastic. And I just think actually, because we are going to get on to United and we're going to talk about their struggles, it's actually only the second home defeat they've had this season. So props to Burnley. They played really good football.
And that goal, Mark, from Jay Rodriguez, it's just sensational, isn't it?
It was. Initially, I was wondering about David De Gea's part in it, but the more I watched it, I just think it was a fantastic strike from Rodriguez, who's had to bide his time in terms of sort of getting his minutes for Burnley, because obviously the Barnes-Wood partnership was the one that Sean Dyche went with. But it was sort of Dyche voodoo magic, sort of back to its best in terms of very little possession. They only had two shots on target in the whole game, but yet they felt very comfortable, particularly in the second half when they closed the game out really easily in the end.
Well, this is the thing. I think you sort of, where do you draw the line between criticising one team and praising another? But there was a huge sort of confidence gap, it felt like, between the two teams. Yes, you know, just said it like Chris Wood's shot does, you know, it's not the cleanest strike, but he attacks that ball and it's the knockdown as well. I forget who it was on the knockdown. It was me, wasn't it? Both of them sort of attacking the ball decisively in those areas. And when you see the contrast the other end of the pitch where, you know, Martial or whoever isn't attacking it, that is, you know, that's what decides these games.
Breaking news from Sky Sports News. Ole Gunnar Solskjaer has retained the support of the Manchester United board despite last night's loss to Burnley at Old Trafford. Does that mean he gets sacked in, what, 3 days, Barry? What does that mean?
Probably. He's a dead man walking, there's no question. What's going wrong at Manchester United? He is partially to blame for the poor performances on the pitch, but he's not to blame for the diabolical squad he's been lumbered with at an outlay over 5 or 6 years of £600 million, as Rio Ferdinand said after the game. Where is that £600 million? You can't see it out there. That's a platitude that comes from board level all the time, and it means nothing. He will lose his job at some point, I would imagine, if not before the end of the season, at the end of the season, because Ed Woodward and the Glazers need a scapegoat for the to pay for their shortcomings, and it is Ollie that will have to pay the price.
United's worst start for 30 years, but they are still fifth. Since Solskjaer took over permanently, they've won 11 league games, lost 12. Even the Norwegian papers, Nicky, are starting to turn on him. Nightmare for Solskjaer, crisis in Manchester, time is running out. Do we think... Because we've obviously talked about this before. I don't know if it's just because it happened last night and it was the last game that was on, yeah, that it feels... But it felt in a way that this could be the moment, right?
Well, it was fascinating, and this is a very Anglo-centric sort of view on it, but having sort of watched the game on BT Sport and then come into Match the Day afterwards, you had two ex-Man United players. So you had Rio Ferdinand on BT Sport, who seemed like he was at the point of existential crisis, like Manchester United doesn't mean nothing anymore, and that was wounding him on a deep personal level. And then Phil Neville on BT Sport on Match of the Day says, oh, I think, you know, he needs more time, bits of what they're doing, I can see they're heading in a good direction. So there are clearly still, you know, there's scope for different views within that. I think the most sort of the most sort of potent thing is seeing Old Trafford that empty before the end of a game. I mean, you think about the fact, I said, Burnley have gone 2-0 up there in two consecutive seasons before this. And at least one of those games, I think United didn't even get their first goal back until about the 85th minute. But there was no sense of hope at Old Trafford anymore. There's no sense that this could happen again. No sense that there's a team still fighting to turn things around. And to me, that, you know, that speaks a damning judgment to the manager. It's not only his fault, clearly. I don't think anyone's suggesting that. The problems at United go all the way to the top of the club, and I think fans inside the stadium, certainly the impression I got watching it from the chants and the anger seems to be much more directed at the Glazers than it is at Solskjaer, and there's plenty of people who still want to let Solskjaer know that they support him. But I don't think that the manager gets a free pass on this either when the team is playing with such a lack of conviction again.
Just to play the Phil Neville role, they had a lot of chances before Burnley scored. You know, Solskjaer can't be Juan Mata's right foot for that chance, or Martial, who takes an extra touch. He can't be Phil Jones, who gives away that free kick for the first goal, which is completely ridiculous.
No, and I think the players do have to take their share of, you know, responsibility as well. I mean, everybody talks about the Glazers and then Woodward and Solskjaer, but the players are still good enough on paper to beat Burnley, even without Paul Pogba and McTominay and Rashford and, you know, Lindelof as well. It's still a good enough team, but I don't know what Manchester United expected from Solskjaer. You know, you've appointed somebody that failed at Cardiff. You know, I've no real idea what he did at Mulder, but it's obviously not a comparable sort of level that he's going into. So I don't feel like he's doing an absolutely terrible job for his ability. And maybe that's where the conflict comes, in that, you know, if you are appointing somebody with relatively little experience of this kind of sort of level, then you maybe do feel like you have to give him time. Obviously, you don't, and he should be replaced. But I think if you've appointed him, I don't know what else you was expecting.
Well, here's the dilemma. I mean, Solskjaer is certainly not, in the scheme of managers Manchester United could have, the most expensive option, right? So you could replace him and get someone else, and you may well be paying more money. And what are you paying for in the short term? In the long term, I think, as Baz says, nobody thinks he's going to last. It's whether or not you need to do something now in the middle of the season. And on the one hand, I look at how this team's playing going, well, there is no point in changing him because this team isn't going to suddenly become great. On the other hand, as you mentioned, you know, they're fifth with, I think it's the lowest points tally any Premier League team has ever had and been fifth this point in the season. Chelsea ahead of them are also not winning games. There kind of is an opportunity because there's so much sort of similar, so much parity, I guess, from the teams from fourth all the way down to the bottom, that actually a little lift might get you into those Champions League places again. So I don't know, it's a dilemma. You know, I think that you would have to feel a really sort of strong sense of conviction about the person you're appointing to replace him. But of course, there are some managers out there who might warrant that level of conviction. I mean, I think there are certainly going to be fans looking at Pochettino and going, that is a manager who you don't normally get without having to get a release clause off someone, having to pay for it. This is your chance to go and get him.
I think what will be of more concern to the club hierarchy than the result against Burnley is the fact that a lot of Manchester United fans didn't bother going to the game. There was a lot of empty seats at the start. Nearly every seat was empty at the end, but there were quite a few. You know, our friend Justin Moorhouse had ticket couldn't get rid of. And he got in a thread on Twitter with various other Manchester United fans who had friends who just couldn't be bothered going. They had no interest in the game. And United are still in a position where, even though the game against Burnley wasn't particularly good, it wasn't particularly entertaining, it was first on Match of the Day. And the reason it was first on Match of the Day is because Manchester United lost. That soon won't be newsworthy. That soon won't make headlines. That's how bad they are.
Yeah. And actually, it's interesting you say that, because we weren't sure whether we should start with it or go, actually, United losing is not such a massive deal. Right?
Yeah, but it soon won't be. They're a mid-table side. I mean, they are not the fifth best team in the Premier League. People will say the Premier League table doesn't lie, but a good statistician, a better mathematician than I, would be able to prove that, yeah, the Premier League table can lie.
This is the fourth game in seven where United failed to score, and Burnley played a part in that, didn't they? I mean, defensively, they were superb.
Oh, they were fantastic. Their back four were outstanding. Lout and Tarkowski, me and Charlie Taylor really put in a shift, and they restricted, they more or less kept United at arm's length and forced them. And it was partly down to the lack of movement from United's forwards, but they just restricted them to long-range efforts, which, you know, grand, fine. You can take pot shots at us all night. We'll keep them out. And, I was hugely impressed with how they kept their shape and kept United at bay.
Do you think Ole Gunnar Solskjaer would be the Man United manager if he hadn't scored that goal in the Champions League final?
No.
Probably not.
No.
Chelsea 2, Arsenal 2. What a brilliant game of football this was. Certainly as a neutral, I don't know, with your Arsenal allegiance, Nicky, how you found it. You must have been, after how it was panning out with that David Luiz red card and the error from Mustafi, and you must have thought, there is no, if somebody said at that moment, you're going to get a point and it's going to be a great point, you would not have believed them.
No, of course not. I mean, I was talking with Mark downstairs when we were waiting to come up to the studio about the fact that Arteta has barely won a game, but somehow it feels brilliant. All of it feels brilliant. And drawing a game like this away to Chelsea, of course it feels brilliant. Because yes, when Mustafi does Mustafi things and David Luiz compounds it by making a foul that you just shouldn't make, I mean, at that point, just let the guy score and give your team a chance to have 11 men on the pitch, is a better decision than what he made. You think it's definitely over. But so much sort of good that follows. Look, it's still a miracle that Arsenal got out of it with a point, because, you know, if you go to expected goals or any of those measures, Chelsea are miles ahead in this game. Arsenal, I think, only had two shots, both wound up going in. But the doggedness of the team, the attitude of Granit Xhaka after getting pulled back to centre-back, the attitude of Arteta not sending on another centre-back and trying to keep a team out there that he thought could at least threaten on the counter-attack and do things, the attitude of Gabriel Martinelli attacking that ball, coming away from a corner and yes, catching a huge break when Kante slips because he had a loose touch on it, but then having the conviction to score, the attitude of the whole team after Azpilicueta's goal, to say, okay, well, there's 6 minutes left and we're on 10 men, we're knackered because we've been on 10 men for 70 minutes, still find a goal because Bellerin, who's just back from a year-long injury, has the sort of willingness to take a shot like that. It feels amazing. It feels fantastic.
Yeah, and great for Bellerin, right? You know, he sent that tweet when bad and good things happen, and he said 367 days and had a quite a nice, he didn't just do two pictures, he managed to sort of fade the pictures together. He must be good on Photoshop. And it said 367 days, and on the left with him with his injury, and then on the right with him scoring that goal. And I don't mean you, Barry, I was not expecting Hector Bellerin to score one with his left foot from the edge of the box.
No, I think he was got a little bit lucky in that it was a clearly crocked Tammy Abraham who was kind of between him and the goal, so he was able to cut inside very easily. But it was an excellent shot. Kepa, the Chelsea goalkeeper, has been getting blamed for it, and I think that's a bit unfair. One defender turned his back to it, and I thought it was harsh, but yeah, very good goal. And a very dogged performance from Arsenal. If I was an Arsenal fan, I would certainly see that as an excellent point. And I think the fact that Frank Lampard was clearly very angry after the game at the number of chances his team missed spoke volumes.
I think you're right. I don't think Kepa should have saved that, but Kepa has the worst shot percentage in the Premier League. Out of 132 goalkeepers have been first choice for their club this season across the top seven leagues. Kepa is sixth from bottom in that he just doesn't save anything.
I thought he should have saved that. I mean, it was a weak shot from Bellerin. It was well placed, but it's not the first time that Kepa has been beaten from a distance. You know, really, you would expect a top goalkeeper. This, you know, he cost a lot of money as well. And if you go on some expected goals sort of mechanisms, he's conceded about nine more goals than he should have this season, which is a huge amount. One of the worst in the Premier League, and I think that Frank Lampard, in his post-match press conference, I think he used the phrase something like, it dribbled in, which I took as him feeling that the goalkeeper should have saved it. There were errors made before then. Tammy Abraham was down for quite a while, and Chelsea had two or three opportunities to kick the ball out of play and decided not to. It was an odd performance, that sort of second half from Chelsea. They played better against 11.
I feel like there's a series of things that relate to Tammy Abraham's injury that need to be said. First of all, on Chelsea's second goal, I'm in the camp, and there seems to be like a real division on this, I'm in the camp that doesn't understand how that isn't offside, because he is very clearly obstructing Leno's view of the ball. And, you know, maybe we need Laws Lars here, but to me that's interfering with play. Like, you can see on the replay, Leno has a very direct, you know, blockage of his line of sight from Abraham coming on. But then there's a sort of interesting conundrum, because exactly as Barry was saying, Abraham lets Bellerin cut inside because Abraham clearly is injured and not moving very well. And that's a conundrum which you see sometimes with teams that have already used all the substitutions. And so are you better off leaving the injured player on the pitch, or are you better off taking him off? Because if he's not on the pitch, someone else goes to the man. But because he's there, a teammate doesn't go over and it leaves that space. So there's sort of Abraham in both goals plays this sort of odd role. I also just want to say I completely agree with what Mark was saying. Chelsea's fans were furious at Arsenal for not kicking the ball out when Abraham went down on the pitch. But then Chelsea won the ball back two or three times. So if they'd wanted to get it out, they could have just got it out. So, yeah, I think there was a lot that related to Abraham in both of those last two goals, actually.
Can we talk about Martinelli? I mean, Nick Ames writing, Martinelli is one of the best 18-year-old forwards I have ever seen. He is going all the way, no question. Nick Ames is not a man to sort of overstate things.
I think the quality of his solo goal has been totally overstated. I think Skodra Mustafi deserves all the credit for an absolutely fantastic assist. That header. That header. My God, I couldn't kick a ball that far. So Martinelli just did the easy, just tapped it in, really, and got took advantage of the Kante slip. So, nah, overhyped for me,
Tom,
Clive.
Tom does say, did Martinelli's goal lose some of the wow factor by him not rounding the keeper? Surely there's an unwritten rule that says after a run like that, you have to round the goalie. I see where he's coming
and
from.
And stop it on the line and kneel down and head it.
Exactly. Martinelli looks like a great prospect, actually, Mark.
He leaves Arsenal in a slightly difficult position now, in that you need to find a place for him in that team, I would have thought. And they've spent a lot of money on Pepe on the other wing. Aubameyang and Lacazette, you already, it's not easy to fit both of them into the starting 11. So, I mean, you do wonder in the summer whether Arsenal sort of go all in with Martinelli and think, well, let's cash in on Aubameyang or maybe Lacazette and try to rebuild the team around him. I wouldn't get overexcited just yet. I mean, yeah.
We have seen a lot of Arsenal, overhyped Arsenal teenagers who haven't cut the mustard, but it's certainly promising. What baffles me is, why was he only playing in the Brazilian 4th Division when they bought him? And how did they find him in the Brazilian 4th Division?
I think, Barry, you know, considering the level of this podcast, to admit shamelessly that you don't watch the Brazilian 4th Division is frankly embarrassing. For Chelsea, you know, Lampard's criticising the fact that, saying that they are bottom of the chances taken league, right? They create a lot of chances. Will Ford on Football 365 saying, look, after 24 Premier League games, Eden Hazard had 10 goals and 10 assists. Between them, Pulisic, Willian and Hudson-Odoi have 10 goals and 10 assists. They were surprisingly flat against 10 men, even though they created that much.
Yeah, and it was pretty much the same against Newcastle as well on the Saturday. I think that I wonder if Lampard, and this may be what Roy Keane was talking about as well, wasn't it, last week, that Lampard does get a slightly easier ride.
Always going to be the case.
I tend to think that they're having about a par season, maybe, where
6 points clear in fourth, right?
Yeah, I mean, they're fourth. They qualified from a difficult Champions League group, certainly more difficult than maybe some of the other Premier League teams had. They're still in the FA Cup. They've got Hull. You know, they should be progressing through to round five. And they're ahead of Arsenal, Tottenham, Manchester United, sort of most of their sort of rivals that they would have thought. So I think it's been an okay season, but they maybe do need somebody else to
Edison
come in.
Edison Cavani?
Well, I mean, he would be one. I mean, I think Atletico Madrid have always been favourites for him. And, you know, Chelsea haven't always had great luck in that kind of department with Falcao and Higuain, maybe for different reasons, not really working out for them in terms of short-termism. I just wonder if you brought in somebody like Cavani, whether you would damage Tammy Abraham in any way or whether he would understand that this is part of playing for a big club.
Has there been any sort of follow-up on that Abraham injury? Because he definitely was injured at the end of that game, and whether or not it's going to mean the thing for
Lampard, I think he said it's not as bad as people thought it was. A bit like the Vardy one, it's not likely to be as bad as we thought.
He walked out without a protective boot on, which they felt was a good sign.
Right, I'll do for part one. Arsenal, after the excellent result behind Southampton in the Premier League, Chelsea go to Hull in the FA Cup, and Arsenal go to Bournemouth. And we will begin part two with Southampton. Welcome to part two of the Guardian Football Weekly Extra. Next week, Liberty Hall in Dublin, 27th and 28th, Monday and Tuesday. We are sold out. So thanks for getting your tickets. We will come back March the 9th and 10th, Glasgow University. We've sold out Edinburgh on the 10th, but we haven't sold out Glasgow on the 9th. And Richard says, do you think the fact that Steve Martin, Martin Short and William Shatner being on in Glasgow the same night as us is the reason for slower sales? Do you think getting in the third amigo, Chevy Chase, would help? Please get Chevy Chase for the Glasgow show. We should be able to announce the last Glasgow panellist on Monday, 23rd of March. We're at Earth in Hackney in London. And 9th of April, we're back in Leeds. I should check my diary. Do you want to check your diary, Baz?
Well, this is all news to me.
No, I know. I've just seen it now.
Thanks for the heads up.
It's exciting, isn't it?
I might be free. Well, I don't know.
So might I. I hope so. Lineups TBC. So, you know, maybe we may not even be selected. Crystal Palace 0, Southampton 2. Derek says, on the subject of this relegation fight, and Palace are in it and Southampton were in it, how many points will be enough to stay up this season? I reckon it could be a new record of 40+. What do you think, Mark?
It's nearly always fewer points than what people anticipate. That kind of magical 40-point mark hasn't been needed for a long time. Obviously, it seems to be creeping up this year. I'd still be guessing around about sort of 37, 38.
Okay.
You overestimate how many times these teams at the bottom win. I know that they're kind of sharing it around at the moment, but that then leads to a reaction of, oh, it's going to be 40 odd points. At some stage, a couple of these sort of strugglers will sort of lose 5 or 6 on the spin.
Palace 0, Southampton 2. Then over the last 12 games, Southampton have won the third highest amount of points behind Liverpool and City. 4 successive away win. Nathan Redmond with an absolute banger. Held it up well, turned, smashed it. Stuart Armstrong with a lovely finish as well. Really, these modern footballs, they don't half move in the air, do they? What a story, Barry. Above Arsenal, 3 points off 5th place.
It's not that good.
Okay. what an okay story, Barry. What a thing to be...
It's not the Bourne Ultimate. Freddie Forsyth, or whoever it is.
What a thing to be slightly less indifferent about than normal.
Yeah, they started the season badly. They lost 9-0 against Leicester, and they've turned things around. And I don't really care that much, I have to say, but it is impressive.
What's Ralph Hasenhüttl done, Mark?
I think he was always, and is a very good coach, and Southampton were lucky to have him. There has been suggestions that he's changed the way that they defend. I haven't seen enough of them to be able to offer an esteemed opinion on to sort of the minute details. But clearly the 9-0, because the ball stuck by him after that, I think it was a a shock to the system for everybody. Since then, they went to City twice, didn't they, after that, and you felt like that could be the end. But they actually competed okay in both of them games, and then since then they've been able to show, I think, bits of form of what we saw last season as well. They've won 5 of their last 7 matches now. This one was done without Danny Ings, and of course, having Danny Ings scoring the amount of goals he has certainly helps a coach. But it looked like they rested him with maybe one eye on the FA Cup tie they've got with Tottenham coming up, and just wonder if maybe Southampton now believe they've got a chance of winning that.
Do you think Solskjaer's mistake is not to get beaten 9-0? He just keeps getting beaten sort of 2 and 3 and by the odd goal.
Well, Hasenhüttl is sort of an example for the likes of Solskjaer or Eddie Howe to look to, in that they look down and out a beaten docket, and he's somehow managed to re-motivate the players. I chatted to Matt Letizier on Tuesday, and we were talking about Southampton's revival, and he reckoned like that the players were getting a little bit lazy maybe, but and he held them totally responsible for the 9-0. I asked him, like, he was at it. I said, when did you leave? And he said, I was in a director's box. I had to stay to the end. But, I would have stayed anyway.
The small talk afterwards.
He has changed the goalkeeper over. And I think Angus Gunn is somebody that, very young goalkeeper, and that there's sort of big hopes for him. But maybe, getting beat every week wasn't great for his confidence. So
probably not.
No, probably not.
Roy was in a right old mood at the end.
Yeah.
Refusing to talk about the Wilfried Zaha, James Ward-Prowse incident that everyone saw. Roy may have gone down the touchline, but those two really don't like each other. There's history there, isn't there?
Yeah, well, a year ago, Wilf Zaha got sent off in a game against Southampton, and it was due in no small part to being constantly fouled and goaded by James Ward-Prowse. So they obviously renewed hostilities on Tuesday night, and I don't think he did anything. What did he jab a finger in his face? It wasn't that big. But Roy Hodgson can be very chippy.
Yeah. It's funny when he is as well.
And I find it quite weird, actually, because Jonathan Wilson is quite good friends with him. They often have dinner together and discuss. Yeah.
Huh.
But I have seen Miguel Delaney on Twitter say, people go, oh, nice old Mr. Roy's kindly uncle. And Miguel going, I've always found him to be thoroughly unpleasant.
Also nice that Cenk Tosun took him a game to realise he was playing for Palace. Ballooned one over the bar, didn't he? And then sort of 50p headed a ball out miles wide as well. So he's making that centre forwards role his own for Palace. To Goodison Park, this was ridiculous, wasn't it? Everton, for the first 94 minutes, this was a very good performance, wasn't it? Created loads of chances. Another goal for Calvert-Lewin. Moise Kean getting his first for Everton. But then Florian Lejeune, who we have not mentioned on this podcast, I don't think ever. And then on Monday, we discussed in great detail how he would dispose of a dead body.
I do apologise, by the way. I forgot to ask Matt Letizier how he would dispose of one. I was halfway home on the train. I suddenly smacked my forehead with my palm. No!
It was just, it's the beauty of football, right, isn't it? Just to see the different reaction between the Everton players and the Newcastle players, the Everton fans and the Newcastle fans, from that moment where Lejeune scores and Pickford is at the back of his net catching the ball, Nicky.
Yeah, I think that, again, on Match of the Day, I felt like Pickford gets singled out because he is, he's out of control in that second goal. He's out of control. He's throwing himself too aggressively after balls that aren't there and winds up, as you say, stopping the ball somewhere behind his own line. But actually, if you see the still shot of when he makes that stop behind the line, if you include him, there are 3 Everton players completely out of the action, because Yerry Mina and Holgate are also both off the pitch and behind the goal line. Mm. So out of 11 players, you've got 3 who have taken themselves completely out of the scope of being able to defend that situation, because everyone is in a state of, we can't possibly throw this away, can we? We can't.
I agree with you. And I actually think that the criticism of Pickford is slightly unfair, because when you show that still image, it obviously looks ridiculous. It's like he's had 10 minutes to position himself and he's stood right at the back of the goal. But actually, he's tried to save a shot, because the ball is going in and it hits an Everton head or something. Mark, you're scoffing at me with your eyes.
I think it comes down to the fact that as was mentioned, I think, on Monday's pod, that he kind of wants to be the star all the time. And it felt a very flamboyant dive that he was trying to make. And I felt there was enough time for him to position himself so that he could have got himself back onto the goal line. Maybe...
I don't think he's above criticism. I just think that singling him out when it's a total collapse of everyone mentally, it's not one player, it's the whole team is doing this.
And also with Everton, I mean, they're the team that's worst defending set pieces in the whole league, and they've conceded another two from such situations. And I think it's 11 now and that they've conceded. So there's a clear problem, I think, just mentally at Everton at the moment. And we saw it against Liverpool in the FA Cup tie when Liverpool scored. The team just shrunk showed absolutely nothing. And I don't think Ancelotti helped the situation after the game when he brought up the fact that he lost the Champions League final from 3-0. And, of course, just reminding the Evertonians it was Liverpool, one of their European Cup successes.
Yeah, we did have a tweet from, I can't remember who it was, I think Robin, a Liverpool fan, saying, do you realise how great it is to be a Liverpool fan right now? United getting beaten up early, Everton doing this.
Pickford, without wanting to further riff on his bit, he was quite at fault for the first goal as well, because he came for a cross and had a bad flap at it, and then jumping around like a scalded cat for the second one. He will have seen, because criticism of him is becoming quite prevalent, I think, quite a lot. He tends not to perform in derbies, in games against, that wasn't a derby, but he's a Macam lad, and games against Newcastle, he tends to get, I don't know, a bit overexcited, and ditto against Liverpool. But he will have seen Dean Henderson's performance for Sheffield United and gone, this is a worry.
Neil says, Barry's statement about the Premier League being full of bad teams seems to be proved right. Even Newcastle have an outside chance of fifth. But doesn't this make the league more entertaining, rather than a sort of dull, know-your-place league?
There was someone having a go at me on Twitter over this comment, and they said that I always find a way to say the Premier League is bad, and that's not what I'm saying. I mean, I'm saying there are loads of bad teams in it. That doesn't make for a bad league. There are loads of bad teams in the Championship, and it's probably my favourite league in the world. But if Manchester United are fifth, and Chelsea, who aren't no great shakes, are fourth, then it doesn't speak, or it doesn't say a great deal about the teams who are beneath them. Now, as I said earlier, I don't think Manchester United are the fifth best team in the league, but the quality is poor, but it's always been poor. 2 years ago, we had a situation where Burnley didn't win any of 11 games either side of Christmas and only dropped one place from fifth to sixth. That doesn't say much for the quality of the teams beneath them, you know. It's always been this way. Rory Smith put it quite well on Twitter the other day when he said the Premier League is good, but it's nowhere near as good as it thinks it is. Hmm.
Let's go to Bournemouth. Massive win for them over Brighton. They scored more goals in this game in their 3-1 win over Brighton than in their previous 9 matches. Yet, Nicky, it was Aaron Ramsdale, probably their goalkeeper, who was the most important player for
them. A segue from Jordan Pickford to Ramsdale. Yeah, he was magnificent. That first, I don't know if it was the first, but early save certainly from Mope, where he makes himself big at the near post, was magnificent. Mm. Tremendous game. So inevitably, we should all get overexcited, say he's going to start for England at the Euros and wait for it all to come crashing down.
He's behind. I've got to get excited about Dean Henderson in a minute,
okay,
and then I can get excited about Aaron Ramsdale. Callum Wilson's first goal since September. He also set up Harry Wilson nicely, Mark, and I thought, actually, that bit of play, because he's desperate for a goal, you could see him snatching at that when the pass was the right thing to do. So he did really well in that instance as well.
Yeah, and I mean, confidence. I mean, I'm a big believer in sort of the numbers, and Bournemouth did score with all three shots on target, that they got three goals. But I think confidence does play a massive part, and actually once there wasn't much time between that Ramsdale save and then Wilson scoring, and you could see, I think from that moment, Bournemouth became a better team. I still think that they're in big trouble. But it was an important, I think, to get Callum Wilson back scoring goals, because if they are to stay up, they need him, because you don't see them keeping many clean sheets. Ramsdale can't play like that every week.
Yeah, you're right. Brighton had 8 shots on target to Bournemouth's 3 and had 65% of the ball. Brighton seems to be getting close to Aaron Moy, apparently for just $5 million from Huddersfield. They have already paid a loan fee. He is 30 and there's not a long lot left on his contract at Huddersfield. But even still, $5 million.
Oh, they should pay it.
But it seems like an absolute bargain.
Yeah, it is.
It's a bargain.
Unless there's something sinister in his background that we don't know about.
He's very close with Florian Lejeune. Villa 2, Watford 1. Tyrone Mings scoring the winner just in the 94th minute. Konsa really deserved the goal. It was a great strike. He celebrates like that. He was devastated afterwards when he found out he hadn't got the winner. But should Tyrone Mings have been on the pitch, Nicky?
I think his first booking was almost an orange for me. It was quite a heavy one. But the second one, which would have been for a handball, he's going past. I mean, you've seen them given with VAR, haven't you? But to me, it's not. It's kicked him a point blank range. His arm isn't in a particularly unnatural position. I think it would have been a tough red card. I just wanted to spin back to the Douglas Luiz goal, because his celebration, I thought, was just magical. Like, he jumps on the advertising hoardings and just sort of falls face first into the crowd. It's not even like he jumps into them. He just sort of collapses into the crowd. I loved it.
Stage dive, yeah. Basically.
It's a trust exercise. Isn't that what you have to do? We should get all the people on the pod together and then we all have to stand up and fall backwards. Or even better, we could all do SAS Uncovered, go to the Outer Hebrides and have to fall backwards into the icy cold water, and the first one to drop out is never allowed on the pod again. Who do you reckon is lasting the course? Because I'm not.
It's not me.
Who's the tough? Is there anyone tough?
Roughly?
Lars.
Bukowski, sorry.
Lars.
You think Greg?
Yeah.
Do you think Lars is tough?
I'd do all right.
Yeah, I think stoic, quiet.
No, just stubbornness.
You think?
Yeah.
Can we put you into an icy bath and just see how long you're stubborn for?
If you want.
Okay, great.
But you have to do it with me.
Producer Jonathan says Paul Doyle. Yeah.
Not so sure about that.
Oh, really? I'm with Jonathan. I think Doyler. Is it
Sean Ingle? Sean Ingle, I think, would have the
persistence. He does ultra marathons as well, doesn't he?
Oh, yeah, he does.
That's true.
He does, like, press-ups in the office.
Oh, no, he's not one of them, is he?
Yeah.
Are you serious?
Yeah.
He doesn't, like, chin-ups on door frames.
Yeah. Oh, he once did... Sid Lowe caught him doing dips in the stairwell of his apartment block. You know, where you...
Yeah.
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 Just and it, like Sid sort of went, what are you doing? Doing dips,
filling the time.
Yeah.
That's why he'll win. Do you think Konsa's got a massive goal bonus? And like, he was so sad when that goal wasn't his.
I thought it was a little bit odd how sad he did get, and it felt like he then remembered the cameras were on him when he right at the end says, "Well, the main thing was that we won." I suppose. It was a bit strange. Yeah, you don't normally see, unless it's Harry Kane, you don't normally see people getting that upset when a goal's taken off them. So, yeah, it was a bit odd. But the main thing was that they won.
It was, yeah. A proper Troy Deeney header from Watford. They had chances to go 2-0 up as well. Pepe Reina made one decent save from Deeney early in the second half. To Bramall Lane, Sheffield United 0, Manchester City 1. Luke says, is it a mandatory requirement to question if a goalie should be England's number one every time he makes a good save? Pope at the weekend, now Henderson in the week. I had written Dean Henderson saves a penalty. Interesting, after having that Pope Pickford chat on Monday, where Dean Henderson fits. Where does Dean Henderson fit?
Well, he's behind Ramsdale now. So.
Oh, really? God, it's tough, isn't it? He did encroach on that penalty.
Yeah, as did several Sheffield United players.
Well, he didn't...
They encroached. Yeah. He came off his line.
If he encroached, his positioning would have been pretty poor, wouldn't it? But the best Dean says, how do you figure Man City get to retake a penalty twice for encroachment against Wolves, but Dean Henderson can be plucking Gabriel Jesus' moustache when he takes a penalty and not a snip of a review? Do refs have short-term memory loss, only remembering one thing they're supposed to focus on? So the defenders don't matter because Henderson gets the ball himself, so they're irrelevant in this. And VAR is not checking this, as it did in the Women's World Cup, wasn't it, where basically every penalty was retaken 5 times. But he was a long way off his line.
Is this the moment to discuss the magnificent Turkish second division video that you circulated around our group chat.
I mean,
before the
why
pod.
Not? Turkish third tier, and the keeper saves a penalty in the last minute. It's retake. He gets booked. Right,
coming off his line.
Yeah, it's retaken. He comes off his line again. He saves it. He gets sent off. So they put a centre back in goal who saves the penalty again. I mean, it is glorious, isn't it?
They were 2-0 up at the time in the 94th minute. So it would have needed a Lejeune like sort of comeback.
But oh, don't bring facts to this, Mark. Now, City missed another penalty. Barry, Pep says he's let whoever's feeling right take the penalties. Now he says Edison is the best penalty taker at the club, which is not a surprise, actually, is it? The way he strikes a ball.
No.
Would you put Edison on penalties?
Me, I personally would. Only because I don't care whether he scores or not. If I was Pep, I probably wouldn't, because if he misses, it could lead to all sorts of problems. But I'd be wholeheartedly in favour of him taking penalties.
But as we've discussed, the season is basically over, right? Liverpool have won the league. City are so far ahead of these teams that are faffing around in mid-table. Surely this is your moment.
Mm. This reminds me of a moment, I may have told this story before, I definitely have to you, Barry, when Cambridge United were already relegated from the Football League, or League One, I forget, and Lionel Perez was our goalkeeper, and he was a cult hero, even though he was on the halfway line most of the time, and so got lobbed all the time, and we got a penalty late on. And we were like, come on, Lionel. The manager, John Taylor, said, go on then. And he took this penalty, hit it as hard as anyone has ever kicked a ball. And it basically broke the opposition goalkeeper's ankle. It didn't go in. And there was a delay for like 20 minutes. He just jogged back into his goal. Sheffield United were really good in this game. And it needed a sort of seamless Kevin De Bruyne assist and a perfect run from Aguero. And it is a sign. I saw the Shoreham viewer, Sheffield United's sort of Twitter account, making the point that, you know, City time-wasting at the end of a game to beat Sheffield United 1-0 is a sign of where Sheffield United are. No, Mark? Once again, you're doing a scoffing eye.
Well, I mean, but Man City did this last year against Burnley. You remember the Guardiola brought on a couple of extra centre-backs. It's just, you know, if you're winning by one goal, you are going to do that. They're not so cavalier that they're going to throw everybody forward when they're winning by only one goal to nil. I mean, Sheffield United did very well. McBurnie nearly got his toe onto across, maybe would have been offside anyway, but just before City scored, it was a good performance from Sheffield United, but I wouldn't read too much into the fact that City were keeping the ball late on. I do think it's odd, though, that Pep Guardiola, a man who spends like, he just fascinates over every aspect of football and every fine detail, and yet he has this really blasé attitude towards penalties. In the book Pep Confidential, he before the Super Cup final against Chelsea, which went to penalties, he said, lads, there's no list, you choose. And that just doesn't feel like a Guardiola type sort of way to look at football. So I think he's had the penalties sort of wrong for a while, actually, and just sort of not caring that much about them.
David Beckham's MLS franchise Inter Miami apparently have made contact with representatives of Sergio Aguero and David Silva. So they'll be quite good, won't they? And the back page of The Guardian today is David Conn writing, revealed the scale of Manchester City's FFP breach before 2014. This is about $188.75 million from sponsorships in 2012, 2013 from companies in Abu Dhabi. UEFA added $60 million to City's losses. That meant an increased deficit of $31 million. Why does that matter? Well, this thing called the Adjudicatory Chamber of UEFA's Club Financial Control Body, the CFCB, stay with me, Barry, is understood to be hearing the charges this week. It could ban City from the Champions League. Quote, the CFCB is understood to have recommended a year's ban at least if the charges are proved. City vehemently denied the allegations when the charges were brought, said they'd been subjected to a hostile process which ignored a comprehensive body of evidence. Just before we end part two, let's look ahead to tonight's game between Wolves and Liverpool. Can Wolves be the team to beat Liverpool, Barry?
They would be among a handful of teams I would nominate if I had to pick a short list of teams who might beat Liverpool. I have no idea whether they will or not. They're good enough to beat Liverpool.
Robin says, having never been the fan of the team that's the best in the league, as Liverpool currently are, is it common for everyone to direct their hate to the team, or is it just because we're Liverpool and people genuinely don't like us?
Normally the team top of the table is unpopular. Not always, but normally I think that's true.
I think that's nonsense. It's our correspondent has got his tinfoil hat on. A lot of people like watching Liverpool. They like Jurgen Klopp. But they would find it amusing if they did a Devon lock and lost the league. It won't happen, but... people read negative stuff about their own teams and ignore any negative stuff about lots of other teams. Lots of people hate Manchester City, lots of people hate Chelsea, lots of people hate Manchester United, but he only sees the negativity directed towards Liverpool.
Yeah, I like Liverpool. There you are. I think there's lots to like about them. Klopp,
yeah, there's
wonderful.
Also lots to dislike.
Now, Manchester City, this is from the Liverpool Echo, have been asked for information on the alleged hacking controversy with Liverpool by the FA. Liverpool apparently paid City £1 million in 2013 when a confidential agreement between the two clubs was reached following a complaint from City that their scouting system had been hacked. The football governing body are hoping City provide evidence for them to examine and decide if there is a case to pursue against Liverpool. So we will keep you posted on this. City alleged their login had been used on the Scout 7 system on a number of occasions by several Liverpool employees.
Well, all available evidence would suggest there is a very big case to answer. Mainly the fact that a large sum of money was paid to please stop talking about this and make it go away.
Barry, if you get my login, I'll let you have my login if you give me £1 million.
I don't... You wouldn't have anything interesting.
You don't know that. I have a
fair idea.
I may have a secret past with Florian Lejeune. Anyway, that'll do for part two. Part three will begin at White Hart Lane. Welcome to part three of the Guardian Football Weekly Extra. Tottenham 2, Norwich 1, Spurs' first league win of 2020. Hugo Lloris is back. Happy times at the Lane.
Happy because they got a much-needed win, but I would argue they didn't necessarily deserve to win. And I suspect Norwich will have gone back to East Anglia feeling they left at least one, if not all 3 points, behind them.
I think you're probably right. Lo Celso and Ali played well. Lamella did a Rabona, which Lamella likes to do. I watched a lot of Tottenham, Mark. I feel Heung-Min Son, right, and he did score the winner with possibly the least courageous header of all time. He's like closed his eyes and just hoped it hit it. It wasn't Steve Bull would not have been proud of the way he scored that, but he still scored it. In the last few years, he has scored a lot of brilliant goals from outside the box. His finishing has been great, and it feels like it's been slightly off this season. And obviously, that makes a big difference, especially when no Kane.
Yeah, I absolutely agree. I mean, I watched this game. It was a hard watch, really, from a Tottenham point of view, apart from Lo Celso. And I think once the collective breaks down, then it's very difficult for any of the individuals, to shine bright. I think that if they are to play this, Kane-less system, and they don't bring in a kind of proper number nine in what's left of the January transfer window, then Son needs to... I think Son should play up front and Lucas should play on the wing. He seems to pick Lucas because he's better in the air and can sort of get the flick-ons for the longer balls that they're playing. But I think they can't get the ball to Son quick enough because there are other areas of the team that aren't working. So you need to get him into that key area of the team. And there's a couple of sort of local Tottenham journalists that believe Dele Alli could play maybe as the number nine in this system. I certainly don't think Lucas is the answer for the rest of the season. And Norwich definitely deserves something from this game. It was just same old for them. They created chances, they missed the chances, and they gave away cheap goals at the other end.
Well, I still think Norwich could get out of this somehow. I mean, they look, every time I see them, I'm impressed with them.
They're just not scoring enough goals.
Timu Pukki has scored goals. He's scored this season, this is from Richard Jolly, against the Champions League winners, the Champions League finalists, the Europa League winners, the Europa League finalists, and the Premier League champions this season. Lloris almost got his penalty. But as everyone said, Norwich deserves something from this game. In Spurs transfer news, Gareth Bale's agent, Jonathan Barnett, says a loan move to Spurs is ridiculous. He does say a lot of things. Spurs apparently after Real Sociedad's Brazilian striker, William Jose. Mark, what are we...
I mean, there's no way that you'd pay 50, 60 million that I've seen mentioned for him. I also did see that it was maybe just a note that was left over from Jose Mourinho to Daniel Levy saying, get Willian, comma, Jose. it's been misinterpreted somewhat. I mean, he is a target man centre forward that scores and sort of average amount of goals in La Liga. No, that may be a little bit unfair to him. He's doing well in a quite attack-minded team, but he's not a 50, 60 million euro player, I wouldn't have thought.
To the King Power, Leicester 4, West Ham 1. Leicester a third, 14 points clear of fourth. Harvey Barnes, Ricardo Pereira, two for Jose Perez. That Pereira goal, Nicky, was lovely, wasn't it?
Oh, yeah, beautiful goal. My mind's just on Harvey Barnes because I thought he had such a good game. Did wonder if he wasn't offside on that first goal, but he seemed to be motoring up and down that flank the whole time. He's so quick in possession, so direct with the ball. When he's like that, you think that really makes Leicester go. Of course, some worry about the Jamie Vardy injury and what it's going to mean for them in the longer term, but they were, 2-1 in this game when he got injured? So 1-4-1, so they find ways.
Did anyone else enjoy, you mentioned Harvey Barnes, his sprint with Pablo Zabaleta, which Barnes gave him a 20-metre start over 20 metres and still beat him.
It was basically all Zabaleta was missing was a walking stick to wave in anger at this young whippersnapper who'd, you know, left him in his dust.
It felt to me like, you know, in Gladiators when they go, you know, Pablo, you'll go on my first whistle. Harvey, you'll go on my second whistle. Or, you know, Wolfman is chasing you up the wall and it doesn't matter. You're just going to get caught, aren't you? Jamie Vardy's injury, by the way, Brendan Rodgers said it wasn't a hamstring, but
he pulled a muscle in his arse.
Yeah.
Let's call a spade a spade.
And if you pull a muscle in your arse, Barry, how many pods do you miss?
You
play through the pain.
Yeah, I'd be able to sit through the pain. I don't know. I've never had that injury.
CC says, how much damage will the West Ham board do to West Ham before they sell up? They've ripped the heart and soul out of the club. They've moved us to an athletics track. What else? Martin Kellner writing, here's a tip for any of our supporters wanting to follow West Ham or BT Sport. Stick to the Big Match Revisited. We're on quite a lot, mostly from the mid to late 70s. And West Ham's next four fixtures, Mark, Liverpool at home, Brighton at home, Manchester City away, Liverpool away.
And after that, Southampton, Wolves, Tottenham, Chelsea, Arsenal. So this is, this is a really, obviously, difficult period. It's going to take something, I think, pretty special for them not to be in the relegation zone, come out the end of kind of those fixtures, and then you're down to like the last couple of months of the season. They've had no real kind of new manager bounce, probably because he's not a new manager in the first place. The midfield is so pedestrian that there's talent in that midfield, but it just lacks sort of the ability to be able to get around the pitch. And against a team like Leicester, it really shows up because that's one of the things they do so well. They're much better, I think, when Antonio, he came on at half-time and gave them an injection of pace. They're just much, Haller needs help up front. When he played for Eintracht Frankfurt, he had Rebic and Jovic sort of alongside him. And, you know, between the three of them, they scored a lot of goals. At West Ham, he's on his own. And then the team just looks like it could be sort of sleepwalking towards relegation at the moment.
Weirdly, there was a moment at 2-1 when Antonio had, I think, a little backheel inside the box that Schmeichel didn't know a lot about, but managed to stop just sort of by dint of standing where he was standing. And yeah, Antonio could have equalised then if it had. Maybe a different outcome.
Barry, Fit Bar Corner in part three of the Guardian Football Weekly Extra. It's an exciting place for it.
The much maligned Fitbar Corner.
Yeah.
The Scottish Premiership resumed last night after the cup matches of the weekend, and Celtic beat Kilmarnock 3-1. Lee Griffiths got on the score sheet for the second game in a row. So he's back in form after, you know, a long spell out of the team because of his mental health issues. After he scored one, provided one assist. After he scored, he ran in the direction of the Sky Scotland commentary box and put his hands behind his ears and sort of directing a message at Chris Boyd, a pundit formerly of Rangers, who had said a couple of weeks ago that Griffiths only had a month to save his career. And after the game, Chris Boyd, who is the ambassador of his own mental health charity, said with what can only be described as a touch of a smirk playing around his lips that the reason Leigh Griffiths hadn't been in the Celtic team for so long and had played so few games
in recent times is because he clearly wasn't putting it in training and that he was lazy, which I thought was an absolutely scurrilous thing to say, but it went unremarked upon, really, as far as I can tell. Elsewhere, there was also an incident where Griffiths was substituted and he got in a bit of a rammy with a Kilmarnock fan. I think he threw his sock, rolled up ball of sock tape at him, and that was that might be investigated by the SFA. Elsewhere, Celtic remained 2 points ahead of Rangers, who beat St Mirren 1-0. Jermaine Defoe with the goal there. So possibly an England recall in the offing.
Well, it might need to be.
And Hamilton lost 2-1 against Hibs, and the Hamilton manager, Brian Rice, has been in the news recently. He reported himself to the SFA for breaching betting rules after relapsing in his ongoing battle against a gambling addiction, and his violations covered this season and each of the previous four campaigns. He says he admits he's had a problem for 30 years. He was very nearly jailed in, I think it was Dubai a few years ago, because he ran up gambling debts of $65,000, couldn't pay them, and some friends bailed him out. He described his addiction as a horrible, isolating disease, and he faces a hearing on the 30th of January, and so he could face a ban. But he's got the full support of Aberdeen. And yeah, it'll be interesting to see how that pans out. There has been a suggestion that he might have made this admission in the hope of leniency, but I think if he is in the grips of gambling addiction, which it seems to be the case, then he probably deserves leniency.
This from Tim from the Championship. Says, nice balanced view on QPR Leeds from Flo on Monday. Yeah, Flo got a bit of stick for saying she didn't love Leeds United from some Leeds United fans. So we're all football fans here.
We're not here to provide balance. That's a mistake a lot of people seem to make. I thought it was great. She really hates Leeds, and she had no problem admitting it.
No mention of the double handball for the QPR goal. Hope you'll be raising West Brom, who currently have worse form than Leeds, falling apart on Thursday's pod. Well, West Brom, Mark, they lost at home to Stoke. It's quite amazing when you just look at the league table of the Championship and you see West Brom and Leeds, first and second, and then the form guide, you know, just has like the last five results.
It's all red.
It's all red with some grey, and there's no green. There's one win from Leeds in the whole of it.
And West Brom, I think, probably... And with Leeds, you could maybe argue that things have gone against them a little bit. West Brom, I thought, put in a really poor performance again, this time against Stoke in that defeat. Dean Garner, the lone star that's done so well for them, got injured very early on in that game, and it takes a lot out of their team when he's not playing. Pereira, the another signing in the summer that did so well in the first part of the Championship, he's gone quiet. There's definite nerves there. Of the two, I would say that West Brom are definitely sort of more vulnerable than Leeds.
Okay. Nicky, Serie A, what an interrupt to. You know, from the outside, it looks like they're buying old people.
Yeah.
Why?
It's a very particular moment. I mean, Antonio Conte has been hammering this line all season, even when things were going great at the beginning of the season. Like, he would come out of some games and just have these press conference rants about how he doesn't have enough options on his bench and who's he supposed to turn to. You know, this kid from Cagliari, this kid from Sassuolo, referring to Nicola Barella and Stefano Sensi, who, by the way, have been his best two players this season, other than Lukaku and Martinez up front. And when you look at the way the team has played, some of their biggest games, you've seen this sort of repeating pattern of coming out of the blocks, all guns blazing, playing this incredible, intense football, and then fading at the end. You saw it away to Barcelona, where they lost 2-1. You saw it away to Borussia Dortmund, where they went 2-0 up and didn't hang on to it. And when you look at that from the outside, what you think is he's got such this demanding, intense way of playing. It's asking too much of players to do it over 90 minutes, or at least where their fitness level is right now. So the last thing you'd think you would need is a bunch of more players in their 30s. Mm. But that seems to be what he is doing at the moment, is sort of gathering all these sort of names that are familiar to him, that are experienced, and he has been, again, banging the drum for, I don't have enough experience in my side, from the beginning of the season. So, you know, the proof will be in the pudding. In terms of the team's performance level overall, there has been a sort of slight feeling they're just tapering off slightly. I mean, they've drawn four of the last six in the league. They're still only 4 points off Juventus, and the pace that's being set by Juventus is as ever incredibly high. So it's no shame in being on 47 points after 20 games. But there is a sense that something was needed, but it's definitely an odd tack that he's going down. What I think you could say about Conte is probably, I don't actually think this rhetoric is too unfamiliar to anyone who saw him at Chelsea, at Juventus. I think he always does this during seasons. He goes off on his sort of mad rants about, I need this, I need that, I'm not getting enough support. But Inter are sort of pandering to it in a way that perhaps some previous clubs haven't. They're a bit still in awe of him and a bit sort of, I guess, all aboard this Conte experience. And so they're trying to appease him.
Do you think they'll get Eriksen?
See, Eriksen's the big one. And it's sort of been a fascinating negotiation, or at least sort of builds a negotiation in the Italian press from the, obviously not in the negotiation, but from the outside, it feels a lot like this negotiation is, you go to Daniel Levy and say, we'll pay you 10 million. And he says, the price is 20 million. You go away and say, okay, 12 million. The price is 20 million. 15 million. The price is 20 million. So it's a negotiation in which one side is negotiating and the other side isn't. But I don't know. It feels like, from Tottenham's point of view, why wouldn't you get something for this asset? Mm. And from Inter's point of view, he's probably the most interesting to me of all the players they're going after. I'm not entirely convinced that Eriksen wants to go to Inter. I think he might still be himself sort of kind of happy to stall it out and see if something more interesting comes to him. I also don't 100% see how he fits in their current setup. And then playing 3-5-2 all season, are you going to put him at wing back? I mean, you've got Kandreva.
Can't imagine.
Right. Or are you going to put him as one of the midfield three and have him sort of playing it in quite an aggressive way, pushing on? Or are you going to have him as an alternative to Lukaku and Martinez as a centre forward? None of those are his natural home, right? So there's some question to me about where he would fit. On the other hand, look, he's a very good player, and I think he's still at an age where you think you can get a lot out of him. And I would say even at 20 million, he's worth it.
Do you think, you mentioned Inter sort of stuttering a little bit, they're still ahead of Lazio, but Lazio are on a brilliant run. Could Lazio push Juve, right? We want a title race somewhere.
Well, they're ahead of Lazio, who Lazio have a game in hand. So it's notional at the moment. If Lazio win that game in hand, they would go ahead of Inter and to win within three of Juventus. Lazio have won 11 games in a row in Serie A. They beat Juventus twice in the space of like 15 days in the league and the Supercoppa. People keep asking me, are Lazio in this title race? I don't see how you could say a team at halfway point of the season with this many points that's beaten the leaders are not in the race. I don't think they're the favourites in the race. Mm. I don't think that I would give them much more than, I don't know, something like a 5% chance in the race. But they're in the race. They're definitely there. And the longer this run goes on, I mean, we're into sort of pretty unprecedented territory, 11 games in a row for Lazio. The longer it goes on, the more you think it's possible. And certainly with Ciro Immobile and the sort of form he's in, what's it, 23 goals now already? And again, anything's possible.
In the Copa del Rey, social media had a lot of fun because Barcelona were playing in Ibiza. I think Wayne Lineker was trending. Does he own a nightclub in Ibiza?
He owns Lineker Sports Bar. It's a famous, quite a famous place.
Oh, marvellous. They had to come from behind to win in Ibiza. People said a massive come down for Ibiza. You rolling your eyes at that at my jokes here? I've got a few more.
Go on.
Well, I said it all went Pete Tong. In fact, that got read out on Five Live, which I'm not sure if I'm contractually allowed. It's quite exciting. They lost to Ibiza in the Copa del Rey. UD Ibiza of the third tier were ahead from the 9th minute to the 72nd. Griezmann got both goals, including a 94th minute winner. It's a lovely spot, actually. Ibiza for a mini break. No one has Googled quiet part of Ibiza more than I did before I went, though. And Real Madrid had an interesting game as well. They played Unionistas de Salamanca. They won 3-1, Bale scoring on his return. This is from John Bennett of the BBC. It's a fascinating club owned by 2,800 of the fans who pay a membership fee and all have a say. They play at a municipal pitch, and there were pictures of about 50 members sort of helping it get it ready before the game. Real have also signed another Brazilian, Reinier Jesus, 18-year-old, from Flamengo. Not from the fourth division of Brazilian football, so we can be excused for not knowing everything about him. But he links up with Vinicius Junior and Rodrigo, sort of Real Madrid's plan to buy lots of young teenagers. Thank you to Philippe Auclair for bringing this to our attention. From Mundial magazine, Lyon's largest supporting group offering their support with a banner to a legendary French restaurant, Bocuse, because it had recently been stripped of its third Michelin star. It's as French as you could possibly get. It said, Monsieur Paul, who is Paul Bocuse, no one will ever take one of your stars from the heart of the Lyonnais, it says. Bocuse's restaurant is in Collonges. Bocuse's restaurant is in Collonges au Mont d'Or, says Philippe, a short drive away from Lyon. He died on the 20th of January 2018, so this is the anniversary tifo, in the same room he was born in the restaurant. Philippe says, this makes me cry, seriously. It's too much to bear. Vaughan says, can we please mention Alan Pardew for getting his first win in Eredivisie and moving above Lee Catamol's VVV Venlo? So, yes, we can, and we have done.
David, did you see the Ghostbusters tifo that the Den Haag fans welcomed him and Chris Powell with?
No.
Oh, it was fantastic. At one end, they had this 50-foot by whatever tifo. It was a mock-up of Ghostbusters with Pardew and Chris Powell as two of the parapsychologists, and with wearing the proton pack, and then they had the Ghostbusters insignia with who you're going to call, because I think Ghostens something in Dutch is a word they use for the spectre of relegation.
Okay.
And Slimer was there. It was really good, but Pardew was obviously quite touched by this gesture, because I know he's something of an object of ridicule here, but they're really glad to have him. And he was also embarrassed because he said, yeah, this is great, but at some point this is going to be used against me.
Chris Powell led the celebrations towards the fans after the game as well, sort of got all the players in front of that kind of ultra kind of end, and they seem like they're having a good time. And Alan Stubbs' son, one of the players that Pardew's brought in, be a team to watch for the rest of the season.
David says, does producer Jonathan think Bristol Rovers will score their first league goal of the decade this weekend? He says no, 0-0. And finally, from below the line, Gavin Gordon Goals says, Archie Rintut's tweets on depression are a great read and very powerful. I hope he's back in the kebab shop soon. Yeah, lots of people have asked us through this season where Archie's been. He's not been well, but he's been away travelling. He wrote a really powerful Twitter thread about it, which I'd recommend you go and read. He has since changed his bio on his Twitter, his location, as Lucas Podolski's Kebab Shop, which is great to hear. And he'll be back in the kebab shop in the next couple of weeks, and he'll be in the studio next month. And we're all very pleased that he is on the mend. And that'll do for today's pod. Barry, thank you for your time.
You're welcome.
Thank you, Nikki.
Cheers.
Thank you, Mark.
Thanks, Max.
We'll be back on Monday.
For more great podcasts from The Guardian, just go to theguardian.com/podcasts.